Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review dated Thursday, September 10th, 2026. We'll start with an article on the front page headlined 9/11/01, We Will Never Forget, Ordinary Lives, Milliken Musical Explores Connections Shaped by Tragedy, by Danette Beckett, Decatur. Mason Natchuk and Molly Chachansky, both 19 years old, are still considered young by many. However, as actors in Milliken University's latest production, they have the opportunity to see some of life's various conflicts through their characters' eyes. Ordinary Days will be on stage Friday, September 11th, and Saturday, September 12th, at the Virginia Rogers Theater, Cowper Hall in Parkinson Music Center. The directors chose to present the musical early in the university's theater season because of the country's special anniversary. It's not a show about 9/11, but it is a show that's highly impacted by 9/11, Natchuk said. To honor the country during the September 11th anniversary, the Ordinary Days cast will meet at 9:11 a.m. Friday, September 11th, at the 9/11 Memorial along Lake Decatur to sing the national anthem. They have invited the public to join them. The composer, Adam Guan, will attend both Milliken productions and host a question and answer session after Friday's show. Relationships, careers, and other future endeavors are affected by the past and can dictate a person's next move. We just see these people in New York going about their lives and running into each other, said Kevin Long, director. But it's just an ordinary day of people's lives and how we impact each other without even knowing it. This is a story about how we as humans come together to support each other without even knowing it. It's a show worth seeing twice, said Elizabeth Creighton, music director. Before the school year ended in May, Creighton took the cast to see Decatur's 9/11 memorial. It was important to us that they have that connection before they left for the summer to learn the music, she said. During the shows, the cast will be collecting donations for the upkeep of the local memorial. Meeting the organizers of the 9/11 memorial was an experience, the cast members said. Even people here in Decatur are touched by it from so far away, Natchuk said. They still have such a community behind it. It was touching to hear about the amount of dedication that went into getting the I-beam and getting it here safely and in one piece, Chachansky said. It was a testament to how people's lives were affected. 9/11 Milliken University performances. The cast of Milliken University's Ordinary Days will meet at 9:11 a.m. Friday, September 11th, at the 9/11 Memorial near Lake Decatur to sing the national anthem. The public is invited to join them. Later that day, the cast will be on stage for the musical. The show will be at 7:30 p.m. Friday, September 11th, and Saturday, September 12th, at the Virginia Rogers Theater, Parkinson Music Center, Cowper Hall. Tickets are $15 and available online at milliken.universitytickets.com. End of life law faces courtroom challenge. Judge weighs bid to block legislation before it takes effect. By Hannah Meisel, Capital News, Illinois, Chicago. Illinois is set to become the first Midwestern state to allow terminally ill adults to take life-ending medication prescribed by physicians when the law goes into effect late this week. But a federal judge is weighing whether to block the End-of-Life Options for Terminally Ill Patients Act, or EOLA, from its September 12th operative date, after hearing arguments Friday in a lawsuit that alleges EOLA discriminates against people with disabilities. The suit also claims the law runs afoul of federal law, including the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Affordable Care Act. Thomas Gehagan, who represents the disability rights groups, physician and disabled Illinoisans who brought the case, told U.S. District Judge John Tharp that the law upends the millennia-old tradition of the Hippocratic Oath, a pledge doctors make to first do no harm. As a result, Gehagan argued, EOLA will result in the severe impairment of the relationship a patient with disabilities has with his or her physician. It's our view, ultimately, this is authorizing a different standard of care, he said. Disability rights advocates fiercely opposed the 2-year effort to pass the law, warning that physician bias in perceived quality of life may make doctors more inclined to encourage life-ending treatment over other options for people with disabilities. On Friday, Gehagan contended this risk of coercion could be exacerbated by the reality of the American healthcare system, in which people with disabilities are often also poor or on public aid. Other countries that allow medical aid in dying, like Canada and some of Europe, have socialized medicine systems, he pointed out. It's a whole different bag in the United States, Gehagan said, because you can go out into the street right now and run into someone who's a defendant in a medical debt case. A whole lot of Americans are uninsured or underinsured. But the attorney defending EOLA on behalf of the state argued that the law contains a key stopgap. Physicians are only allowed to discuss lethal options with a terminally ill patient if the patient is the one who brings it up. EOLA only applies to adults with less than 6 months to live, a prognosis that must be confirmed by 2 independent physicians. Patients must request lethal medication both verbally and in writing, and doctors are required to inform them of alternate hospice care and pain control options. Additionally, a patient requesting the medication must pass a mental evaluation by a physician to determine that they are mentally capable of making the decision and not facing undue influence. Patients must also be physically able to self-administer the medication. But Gehagan argued that the law doesn't require enough state oversight to the doctors determining whether a patient is a candidate for medical aid in dying, a term proponents of the law often use. Opponents, which also include religious groups like the Catholic Conference of Illinois, preferred to describe it as assisted suicide. Because EOLA doesn't contain an objective, state-engaged standard for doctors to make those determinations, Gehagan told the judge, the law amounted to a violation of due process rights for people with disabilities. Tharp asked Elizabeth Morris, a high-ranking litigator in Attorney General Kwame Raoul's office, to respond to Gehagan's argument that EOLA lacks a process to assess the validity and legitimacy of actions that might be taken under the statute. I would argue the Act itself sets forth this very thorough process to slow things down and give doctors the opportunity to assess patients, Morris said, noting that doctors are trained to walk patients through informed consent, which she also said is explicitly spelled out in the law. And because doctors are responsible to the state, both to maintain their medical licenses and under medical malpractice law, Morris argued Illinois has already put these guardrails in place. Tharp said he would make a decision on whether to grant the preliminary injunction before the September 12th effective date. Another challenge is pending. In a separate challenge to EOLA filed last month by religiously affiliated healthcare systems and doctors, another federal judge in Chicago approved a temporary restraining order agreed to by all parties. The stipulated TRO exempts the plaintiffs from having to discuss lethal medication with patients until the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decides a case concerning similar themes. In that case, stemming from a 2016 law requiring that, if requested by the patient, providers who don't perform abortions must refer, transfer to, or give patients written information about providers who do. A federal judge in Rockford issued a mixed ruling in the case last year, which the parties swiftly appealed. The appellate panel heard the arguments this spring and could issue a ruling any time now. Democratic lawmakers pushed EOLA through to passage in October, and Governor J.B. Pritzker signed it into law in December. The statute is also referred to as Deb's Law, named for former social worker Deb Robertson, a Lombard resident living with an aggressive case of neuroendocrine carcinoma. In her arguments Friday, Morris noted the multi-year effort by advocates to fill the gap in end-of-life care options in Illinois, asserting that the public interest in denying the motion for preliminary injunction here is strong. Decatur Schools. District faces $4.3 million budget deficit for 27. By Valerie Wells. Decatur. The Decatur Public Schools tentative budget for the 2026-27 academic year has a significant deficit. Chief Financial Officer Thomas Osborne said the total budget shows a $4.3 million deficit, while the education fund, which is the one used to pay teaching staff, will be the hardest hit. That fund has tentative revenues of $114.8 million, with expenditures of $121.9 million, leaving a $7.1 million deficit. The district's total budget, counting all funds, including transportation, tort fund, operating expenses, work, cash, and others, is $153.7 million in revenue, with a deficit of $4.3 million. Local funds make up 42% of revenue, with the highest expenditures, $71.9 million, in salaries, $24.7 million in benefits, $29.6 million in purchased services, and $6.8 million in supplies. The budget is tentative because final numbers of revenue from all sources typically are not known until the end of the calendar year. Yet, school districts have to create and approve a budget by October 31st. The largest fund is the education fund, and we have more going out than coming in, which gives us a deficit for this year, said Superintendent Nicole Nash Moody. We look at that and say we can control costs, classroom staffing, student support, but we still have to decrease this number. We still have money in the bank, but I don't have all the money I want to because we have more expenses than money coming in. We need to figure out a way to manage this so I can keep money in the bank. We're ending in the green. We still have money in the bank, but the sense of urgency is here. If we don't watch what we're doing and expenses go further than we're bringing in, we're doing everything we can to trim costs. Expenses average a 7% growth annually, Osborne said, while revenue is flat. We can't sustain that for very long, he said. Decatur is a Tier 1 district under the state of Illinois' evidence-based funding for schools, which aims to increase state funding for districts with limited local resources. Tier 1 is the highest need category, and last year, Decatur Public Schools received $90,127,426 of its target amount of $117,229,007, which is a 76.9% adequacy percentage, according to the Illinois report card. Osborne said he already has begun working on a tentative budget for the 2028 fiscal year in order to plan ahead as much as possible. The budget is projections on expenditures, Osborne said. We know what revenues will be. We're making sure with our commitments that we're able to fulfill and meet them, and anything negotiable, we can pull back. We make decisions every day that lead that decrease in the deficit. All fund balances will end in positive figures, he said, and the Illinois State Board of Education's expectation is that a school district will have funds between 20% and 40% of their annual operating expenditures in hand. Decatur will have 27.5%, which is a healthy fund balance. Decatur Schools. Enrollment numbers see slight decline, by Valerie Wells. Decatur. The 10-day enrollment figures are in for Decatur Public Schools, and the district lost 36 students between last year and this one. Total enrollment is 7,381 students, with 5,109 students in elementary schools and 2,272 in middle and high schools. Danielle Lusby, Director of Student Services, told the Decatur School Board on Tuesday that online registration began on July 1st and was supposed to end on July 31st. But problems with Skyward, the program used for registration and student records, required an extension through August 7. Families who had not registered by the deadline were directed to visit their child's school office. Students registered last year, but with registrations not completed by August 18, were flagged as inactive, and there were 103 new students whose registrations were begun but not completed, who are considered inactive at this point. The 10th-day enrollment figures are the ones the state uses for its official records. The board also heard a report on Roadmap 2030 and how the district's implementation of the latest phase of the strategic plan is going, as well as the beginning of the next phase, which is the one where Wold Architects and the district consider the use of district buildings. We have met with principals and departments and begun the work of creating individual SMART goals, said Ashley Grained, Executive Director of Innovative Programs and Strategic Planning for the district. The implementation of the plan on a page has begun. SMART stands for Specific, Measurable, Achievable, Relevant, and Time-Bound. The goals, Grained said, will tackle the plan on a page, which calls for improved student achievement, creating effective learning environments, promote a positive workplace experience, increase family and community engagement, and ensure fiscal stewardship. We will begin designing and developing action plans with key performance indicators, Grained said. We will continue to coach and support. Phase 4, which began over the summer, is planning its first committee meeting at the end of September, said Jay Marino, Executive Director of Systems Alignment and Continuous Improvement. Wold Architects and Engineers, a national firm with an Illinois office in Palatine, has been hired by the district to examine the school's buildings and programs and assist in the decision and planning process. The Stakeholders Committee, made up of parents, staff, union leadership, city officials, and business leaders, will work with Wold to create a plan to configure district buildings in the most efficient way. The committee, Marino said, will offer their shared understanding of facility needs, potential long-term solutions, and provide input on informed recommendations that will support the strategic direction of the district. Wold's team has visited some buildings, and twice monthly meetings will help the group come up with a recommendation to present to the board in February. There has been strong interest in looking at a true middle school concept, Marino said. The core concept is how do we get a real 6-8 middle school concept? We're looking at school choice. How do we expand that? Create college and career pathways and personalization of learning beyond high school. We need to establish it at the middle school level and carry it on through high school. Law enforcement. Decatur extends animal control agreement with Macon County. By Scott Perry, Decatur. The Decatur Police Department will handle investigations of criminal animal control violations within the city limits as part of an extended agreement with Macon County. The agreement, unanimously approved by the Decatur City Council at its Tuesday meeting, has the city paying the county $748,472 for all other services provided by Macon County Animal Control. According to a memo to the council from city manager Melissa Hahn, there is a $25,000 reduction in the amount previously paid by the city to offset costs associated with it taking over investigation duties. Police Chief Brad Allen said that prior to the change, his department handled all felony animal abuse cases in the city, with the sheriff's department handling all other criminal offenses involving animals. "The change will increase the number of animal cases we will investigate," Allen said. "We have met with the new animal control administrator and have established a good working relationship and an operational plan. So we have good collaboration and will work together during the extension and as we all adjust to the changes." Animal control will continue to handle ordinance violations in the city pertaining to animal issues. The extension comes after the city announced last year that it wanted to terminate the intergovernmental agreement, thus opening the door for negotiations of a new animal control program contract. It was during those negotiations that Macon County Sheriff Jim Root announced that after August 1st, his department would no longer oversee the animal control department. Root said the sheriff's office had agreed 2 decades ago to temporarily take over running what had always been a separate Macon County department. The sheriff's office had provided a sworn officer as administrator to oversee a staff of 6 animal control wardens who are not sworn officers with arrest powers. It costs about $1.5 million a year to run the operation, and that total nudges close to $2 million with the rental costs of the Macon County Animal Control and Care Center building included. Due to this change in service structure, it was agreed between city and county staff that a contract extension would be the best approach to allow the county time to restructure the Animal Control Department while still providing animal control services in the city of Decatur, Hahn wrote in her memo. The city will continue to manage the Macon County Pet Registration Program. Of the approximate $400,000 in pet registration fees collected, the city will retain $56,000 to cover the city's costs. The agreement is retroactive to August 1st and will expire on July 31st. Mattoon celebrates 100th birthday of World War II veteran, retired farmer. By Rob Stroud, Mattoon. George Morris served in World War II, became a respected farmer and cattle producer, and raised a family that now includes great-grandchildren during his 100 years. "You have seen and experienced a lot now, sharing with 4 generations. It's a record worth celebrating and needs no further explanation," said his son, Rodney Morris, while reading a poem he wrote for his father's milestone birthday. A banquet hall full of well-wishers joined in this celebration Monday afternoon at the DeMars Center. Attendees included community members from the Champaign area, where Morris farmed for more than 40 years, and from the Mattoon area, where he retired in 2002 to be near his son's family. Dewey Goodrich of Monticello was among the many friends who made the drive south to honor him. Goodrich said he met Morris many years ago through their work in the cattle business and was impressed by his friendliness. Morris was known for raising Angus beef cattle, including a world champion and a bull he exported to Australia. He served several years on the Illinois Angus Association Board. He also drove a truck and hauled livestock for area producers to Chicago. The two men reconnected several years ago when Goodrich's father, World War II Navy veteran Fred Goodrich, and Morris were on the same honor flight to see various military memorials and landmarks in Washington. After the start of Morris's Army service was disrupted by an appendix surgery, he was deployed with his unit in 1945 to the Philippines. Morris said he and more than 40,000 other soldiers there were preparing to take part in the anticipated invasion of Japan when the U.S. military's dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and then Nagasaki ended the war. Morris said his return home was delayed for about 9 months while he and his unit joined the occupation forces in war-ravaged Japan. He was discharged from the army in 1946. Having been born on a farm in Seven Hickory Township and graduated from high school in Humboldt, Morris began building his career in agriculture in East Central Illinois after his service. The veteran married Marge Gardner of Arcola on September 5, 1959, and they subsequently ran a farm and cattle operation together near Champaign. Morris served on the Rising Farmers Grain Cooperative Board for 20 years, most of the time as president. He and his wife regularly attended state meetings for cooperatives and the Farm Bureau. Being close to the University of Illinois, Morris and his wife hosted many international visitors at their farm. He was once featured on the cover of Prairie Farmer magazine as well. Champaign neighbor Nancy Strunk and her husband, Duane, managed the Morris farm, and they all became friends. Strunk said she vividly remembers how proud Morris was that his son, Rodney, and grandson, Cody, both served as Illinois Future Farmers of America presidents. Since moving to Mattoon, Morris has made many new friends here. Mattoon neighbor Mike Croy said he enjoyed sharing meals and being a fan of University of Illinois basketball and football with Morris. "I appreciate him a lot," Croy said, adding he is amazed by how active Morris is, tending to his lawn and keeping up with his great-grandchildren. Rodney Morris said his mother, who passed away in 2022, would have credited her husband's longevity to being ornery. He also believes that his dad remains vigorous at 100 because God still has a purpose for him, which includes looking out for the younger generations of his family. "We are happy to celebrate this milestone with you, but it was the joy with you each day that makes me most glad. You are a blessing, one of a kind, and I'm proud you are my dad," Rodney Morris said to his father. Macon County, victim in fatal Forsyth crash identified by Valerie Wells. Forsyth. Authorities said a Decatur man died Sunday in a head-on crash in Forsyth. Macon County Coroner Michael Burkham has identified the victim as 53-year-old Michael Spencer. At 1:50 p.m. on Sunday, the Macon County Sheriff's Office was sent to a major accident in Forsyth. When deputies arrived, they determined that a Dodge Ram pickup truck driven by a 63-year-old female was traveling westbound on Alinawick Drive and crashed head-on with a Cadillac Escalade traveling eastbound. Witnesses reported that the pickup truck was driving at excessive speeds and erratically, the release said. Spencer, a passenger in the Dodge Ram, was pronounced dead at the scene. The driver of the pickup was airlifted to HSHS St. John's Hospital in Springfield in critical condition, and two people in the Cadillac were taken to Decatur Memorial Hospital in critical condition. During the investigation by Macon County Sheriff's deputies, it was determined that the driver of the Dodge Ram was impaired and under the influence at the time of the accident. An arrest warrant is being prepared for her arrest after she's released from the hospital. We'll take a break now and return with the second half of the Herald and Review dated Thursday, September 10th, 2026. Please stay tuned.